You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, lead water lines continue to be a growing concern in communities around Wisconsin. We'll check in about how the DNR is handling such a large-scale problem. First, the Trump presidency could have major impact. Trump appointed Justice Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court and has more than 100 vacancies to fill on the federal judiciary. One of his most recent nominations for a vacancy on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago has ruffled some feathers. A progressive judicial watchdog group, the Alliance for Justice, has called on the Trump administration to withdraw its nomination of Amy Coney Barrett for the bench. The group says that Barrett has little litigation experience and says that she argues her Catholic religious views can precede U.S. law. Experts have also argued that the president's judicial nominations have gone in a more conservative partisan direction. Ryan Owens joins me now. He's a professor of political science and affiliate faculty in the law school at UW-Madison. Ryan, welcome back.
Yeah, thanks.
Why are some liberal groups wary of Notre Dame law professor Amy Coney Barrett?
Well, I think a lot of them see her as representative of a lot of the nominees that President Trump is trying to get on the court right now. Younger, conservative judges that have considerable clerkship experience and good credentials. I think they see her as a potential Supreme Court nominee in the future, were she to get on the Seventh Circuit. And I think they're going out of their way to try to attack her with this article that she wrote when she just got out of law school. I read the article this afternoon that she published, and frankly, I don't think that it's nearly as problematic as that group suggests it is.
The red flags for these groups who are concerned about her, one of them is that she says that the Bible could precede U.S. law, and the other is that a judge may not have to follow precedent or consider precedent if they disagree with the way the case was handled. Can you unpack those views for us and tell us what they mean?
So let's start with the first objection that they have first, and that is this notion of religious faith and the law. So in 1996, she wrote an article about Catholic judges and what ought Catholic judges to do when they face the death penalty. Now, ironically, she, in this article, opposes the death penalty. So you would think that progressive groups would want to see her on there. But what she argued in this article was that for Catholic judges who are particularly motivated by their religion, what they should do is when they see a conflict between their religion and what they're supposed to do under the law, they should consider recusing themselves. So it's not as though their religion should trump, at least this is her argument, that religion should trump the law, but rather if a judge finds himself or herself so motivated by their religious beliefs that they don't feel they can rule dispassionately in the case, that they should recuse themselves. So you can take that and turn it one way or the other. You can say that that means you're putting the Bible above the law. I think a lot of people would read that and suggest all it means is if you don't feel like you can apply the law fairly, you should recuse yourself in the case. And I'm certainly not going to defend her position or oppose it one way or the other, but I think that's the fairest reading of the article. Now, in terms of upholding or getting rid of precedent, this is a really age-old discussion that professors and others have. I think her argument here was that when it comes to constitutional cases, we should want judges and justices to feel a little bit less constrained by following precedent because the stakes are so much higher. And so if one particular legal vogue falls out of fashion and you get new judges or justices on the court, because this is such a big deal, because it speaks to notions of fundamental values in the country, that maybe we want judges to be able to rethink those precedents over time.
Precedents are not to be taken lightly, though, correct? In law, you're supposed to, they build on one another, and they reach a point where there is maybe a systemic societal change, as is with the gay marriage ruling recently like that, mm-hmm. or you saw it also happening in Roe versus Wade. So do you think that, I mean, it's possibly to be too dismissive of precedent?
Well, right. I mean, one of the fundamental values we strive for in the law is stability. That's one of the foundational concepts of the rule of law is stability and clarity. You and I ought to be able to know what is or isn't legal when we go about our daily lives. At the same time, though, a stubborn grip on an existing precedent can be problematic. You know, you mentioned Roe versus Wade. That, of course, was a new precedent. You think about Lawrence versus Texas, that overruled existing precedent. Brown versus Board of Education overruled Plessy. So, in adherence to precedent is certainly something we should treasure and something that we should value and not dismiss lightly, as you suggest. But at the same time, it's not something that ought to handicap us when it becomes obvious that the precedent needs to go. And that's more or less I don't want to say a policy dispute, but where that line is of course, in the eye of the beholder.
We're talking with Ryan Owens right now. He is an associate professor of political science and affiliate faculty in the law school at UW-Madison. And we're looking at a controversy around the Trump administration's nominee for a vacancy on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, which serves Wisconsin, Illinois, and Indiana. And Ryan, I wanted to ask you about some of her criticisms. We looked at areas of faith when we started off, and she has criticized other judges on grounds of their faith and said perhaps they weren't the best executors of their Catholic faith. Is that something that you regularly see when you look at judges and their responses to one another?
Yeah, I mean, well, two things. First, that's not typically the kind of conversation we observe, from nominees. But secondly, and perhaps more importantly, I read that article that she wrote in 1996, and I did not see that in there. I saw a discussion about Justice Brennan and some of his behaviors when he was on the court, but I didn't in any way get the sense that the authors were trying to disparage Brennan for his behavior at all. I went back and I double-checked that, tried to find it in there, and I didn't see it. Maybe I didn't look closely enough, but I didn't see it there. It's kind of a strange discussion about this nominee. Usually we're talking about different things. Do they support the death penalty or oppose it? This one, she clearly had opposed it. In the discussion here is a little different. Now, I should point out she wrote this article while she was clerking for Judge Silberman on the D.C. Circuit. She later went on to clerk for Justice Scalia on the Supreme Court and there worked on some death penalty cases. So it doesn't appear as though she would be recusing herself were she to become a judge in this matter, because she certainly didn't when she worked as a clerk on the Supreme Court.
Now, we've gotten at this a little bit, but the watchdog group that is opposing her nomination, the Alliance for Justice, has painted her as someone who is outside the pale when you look at the legal system, when you look at judges and lawyers. Tell us more. It sounds like you don't agree with that assessment. You think that it's not too far outside what might be considered normal, to use that term. What do you think? Is that fair?
Well, again, I'm not here to support or oppose her at all. I think what's going on here is that you have somebody who is a conservative jurist with very good credentials. Now, not much legal experience, but I and some others actually don't think that's particularly problematic. But she's got great credentials. She's highly qualified for this position, and I think they see her as a threat. And so what they're trying to do here is find anything they can to take her down now before she gets on that circuit and either renders decisions inconsistent with what they would like to see and or potentially becomes a Supreme Court, potential Supreme Court nominee herself. So I think that's what's going on here. Now, in terms of her jurisprudence and her discussions about precedent and the like, I think these are discussions that law professors have quite regularly. It's just most of them don't wind up being nominated to get on the federal circuits these days. And this is why, because a paper trail is something that can be examined by opponents and highlighted, and it can become problematic for the nominee. But I don't see the discussion that she's had as being, anything that ought to sink the nomination, at least on qualification grounds. Whether a senator opposes or agrees with her on policy grounds, that's an entirely different matter, and I certainly wouldn't speak to that. But in terms of the credentials, in terms of, the history and stuff there, I don't see this as something that's, objectively speaking, hugely problematic, but this is politics, right? And these things tend to take on a life of their own.
How important is an appointment like this in a federal appeals court? There are many of these vacancies across the country, and President Trump has potentially the opportunity to fill very many of them. I don't know if he'll get to all of them. He may. But let's look at this particular appointment. How important is it?
Well, this particular appointment, I think, is it's relatively important. I mean, the Seventh Circuit historically had been a little bit more conservative after the 80s and early 90s. And with President Obama's presidency, he was able to get a couple of more liberal-leaning judges on that circuit. So it's relatively close, I think, to balance right now. And if President Trump is able to get a couple of more conservative judges on that circuit, I think it'll be a little bit more balanced than it has been over the last few years.
There have been various news outlets reporting that the president has a big opportunity for his party to appoint conservative leading judges to the judiciary and taking that in a more conservative direction. Do you see that as being any different than what we might have seen for President Obama, or is this the opportunity of every sitting president?
Yeah, no, this is the opportunity of every sitting president. Now, some presidents get into this a little bit more than others. By all accounts, at least early on in his presidency, President Clinton didn't seem particularly motivated by judges and filling those appointments, whereas President Reagan was really concerned with that. You know, and for President Trump, he really hasn't had a whole lot of success so far. His primary success thus far has been his selection of Neil Gorsuch and getting him on the court. And so, you know, I think a lot of Republicans went to the polls in November and they plugged their noses and they voted for President Trump because this is what they were concerned with, the selection of judges and justices on the Supreme Court. And, you know, in that capacity, he's been very, very successful.
And just a couple of seconds left. Wisconsin Senators Ron Johnson, a Republican, Tammy Baldwin, a Democrat, recently renewed a bipartisan agreement in Wisconsin for a nominating commission to help fill judicial vacancies. Mm-hmm. Does it look as though that will be taken into account by the Trump administration?
Oh, I suspect it will, simply because, you know, Senator Johnson voluntarily took part in this commission. So I think they'll give that some respect. Certainly when you think about the fact that they'll need his vote in the health care bill and in other issues, I don't think they want to do anything to ostracize Senator Johnson. But we'll see how that commission proceeds. I mean, there's three Democrats, three Republicans on there, and I know they're busy right now vetting candidates, and I think they're probably nearing the end of that process, and we'll see what they wind up, who they wind up selecting.
Ryan, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Ryan Owens, professor of political science and affiliate faculty in the law school at UW-Madison, looking at a controversy around the Trump administration's nominee for a vacancy on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, which serves Wisconsin, Illinois, and Indiana. This is Central Time. Local and state officials agreed that Wisconsin needs to replace all of its lead service pipes, but the price tag on that effort is hefty, and there are a lot of complications that make it a difficult undertaking. Here to fill us in on the current status of the lead pipe situation in our state is Scott Gordon, reporter for WisContext. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Can you give us the current state of things when it comes to replacing lead water lines here in Wisconsin?
So right now, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources and, you know, a few dozen local governments are in the midst of this kind of EPA-funded grant program that's administered by the state, where the state is parceling up about $14 million between cities to do some lead service line replacement. And these dollars are specifically focused on replacing the lead pipes that are on private property, because water utilities can't use their money that they get from ratepayers to pay for those. They can only pay for the public portions of that work.
And Madison is unique, I understand, in that it has replaced all of its lead service lines, but the rest of the state has quite a few left. Can you give us an idea about what kind of numbers we're looking at here? How much work is there yet to be done?
Well, as far as people know, there's probably about, you know, 170,000 lead service lines around the state. That's from an EPA estimate from a few years ago that, you know, even the EPA kind of admits is not necessarily perfect. It's kind of hard to get a definitive count short of kind of digging up each one of these.
And in terms of which cities might be hit particularly hard by this problem, which cities are you focusing on?
Well, Milwaukee definitely has more of them than in the other city, about 70,000, and slowly counting down as they gradually replace them. But, you know, there's other cities around. Of course, Milwaukee, you'd expect it to because it's such a big city. But, you know, there are other areas around Wisconsin. For example, Wausau is estimated to have about 7,000, which is quite a lot for a city of that size. So it's certainly a widespread statewide problem.
You mentioned this EPA program that has been helping to replace private private properties with lead on them in terms of the pipes. Is that program going to continue? What do we know about the future of that program?
Well, basically, it's money that the EPA gives to the states, and the states have some discretion as to what they're doing with it. And this is how the DNR has chosen to use some of that for fiscal years 2017 and 2018. It's not necessarily clear what's going to come from the next federal budget in terms of this funding, because there are some big cuts planned to the EPA. But a lot of that funding that EPA gives directly to states looks like it's going to be fairly flat in the budget proposals that are out there so far, you know, actually increasing a little bit. But it's not necessarily clear that the DNR is going to continue to use it in this way after 2018. A couple cities that we talked to told us that DNR has said that they're not going to continue doing this. DNR did not respond to our request for comment for that story.
And the Obama administration, they did approve a program that would help address lead pipe abatement. Where does that program stand?
Right. So late last year, Congress passed and Obama signed a bill called the WIN Act. And it does include, you know, several hundred million dollars in funding for lead pipe replacement. But Congress hasn't actually provided that funding yet. And, you know, even that, you know, $300 million, obviously that would do a lot. But when you spread it around the country, it wouldn't really be that much. I mean, it would cost at least $1 billion. And that's probably a conservative estimate to replace the lead service lines that we have in Wisconsin now.
So nationally, we're talking billions of dollars to get this done, right?
Yes.
So looking back again at Wisconsin, you zeroed in a little bit on the city of Green Bay and some approaches and ideas they've had. What are they talking about?
Well, basically, people have had to get creative with finding money for this when, again, water utilities are limited in how they can spend their money, and there's only going to be so much help from the state or the federal government. Green Bay used some money that it had left over from its share of sales taxes from Lambeau Field to replace some lead service lines. In Madison, the big effort that you mentioned earlier, which, again, doesn't have a lot of parallels anywhere else in the country. There's maybe a couple other cities that have done anything close to that. One way the city got some money to do that was through cell tower leases, for instance. And right now, the state legislature is working on a bill that would give water utilities some more flexibility. That's being sponsored by Robert Coles, who's a Republican state senator from Green Bay. It also has bipartisan support in both chambers, but obviously everything right now is taking a backseat to this state budget impasse. So it might not be until fall until this even really comes up again.
We're talking with Scott Gordon right now. He's a reporter for WisContext, and we're looking at the effort to replace the remaining lead pipelines, particularly to private properties in the state of Wisconsin. And, Scott, we haven't talked about the health ramifications there. We've seen what happened with water quality in Flint, Michigan. We know about the health issues that can result. But tell us a little more about why this is such an urgent problem.
Well, I mean, there's really no good reason for lead to be in your body in the first place. It's not one of those metals that has some kind of beneficial role in human health. And it builds up in your system over time incrementally. So especially if you're a young child, if you're exposed to kind of a little bit here and there over the years, that can have really important cumulative effects on your development in all sorts of ways. It is a very real public health concern.
And it's complicated because replacing part of a lead pipe might not help. In fact, it might make things worse because it just might loosen further lead sediment that will go further down the pipe. Is that right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, just about everybody who deals with this stuff recommends against that because you can shake loose kind of rusted lead deposits that are in there and send more of that lead into the water. depending on what kind of metals you're using, it can create this galvanic effect that also puts more lead in the water. Yeah, people have basically said, if we're going to do this, we need to find ways to replace both the public and the private half. Otherwise, we're not really solving the problem.
What about lead that might occur in the actual groundwater? Is there any way to get rid of it completely?
I mean, there's ways to filter it and so forth. I mean, even in Madison, the water here has that. Even with all our lead service lines that we know have gone, there's still lead in Madison's water, just because there are natural deposits. But, you know, I mean, there's filters that you can put on the faucet and things like that, and filtration that water utilities can use. But, you know, it is tough when it's out there to get it to be completely lead-free and completely reliable.
So looking down the road and the possibility of a lack of funding coming from the DNR in the future, what do you expect? What are the best prospects for movement on this, replacing lead pipes in Wisconsin?
Well, it's really hard to predict. And even people who work on this issue and have a sense of urgency about it, you know, will kind of say, well, you know, obviously it's asking a lot to replace all of this. And there's a lot that can be done with corrosion control, which is basically, you know, using various chemical treatments in drinking water so that the water won't dissolve as much of the lead in the pipes. And that has had a huge effect over the years on reducing lead levels and reducing lead exposure. But, you know, obviously it's not perfect, and there's still plenty of communities around the state that have lead in their water.
Scott, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Veronica.
That was Scott Gordon there from WisConText, and we're learning about the latest efforts to replace lead pipes in the state's municipal water systems. For more on that topic, go to wisconText.org. The smell of cream puffs is in the air. That's right. It's fair season in Wisconsin. That's a clip from the Wisconsin State Fair commercial. The State Fair this year runs from August 3rd to the 13th, and county fairs are popping up all over the state right now. To a lot of people in Wisconsin, fairs mean rides and music and fun fried foods. But there's another big component to these fairs that we're learning about today, the agricultural component. And we want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. What are some of your favorite fair memories? Did you compete in local and state fairs when you were younger? And are your kids participating in agricultural programs at the fair, maybe the county fair, maybe a 4-H program? And what's your favorite part about going to the fair, the state fair, the county fair, anything else along the fairground way? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And you can also share your memories and your experiences over on the Central Time Facebook page. Lee Presley joins us now. She's an agriculture educator with the Racine and Kenosha County UW Extension. Lee, welcome to Central Time.
Hi there. Nice to be here.
Well, what can you tell us about the beginnings of fairs here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so agricultural fairs have definitely been a staple of our summers here since about the mid-1800s. In fact, the first state fair was held in 1851. And one of those first state fairs featured a speech from Abraham Lincoln, where he really kind of emphasized what the key components of the event were to be.
Wow.
And he emphasized their value in, one, bringing people together, and then, two, their value in having farmers be able to come together and share growing techniques, new machinery, demonstrate different practices. All kind of in a fun environment. They could take what they learned at the fair and then bring that back to their home.
Now, it seems like the tradition of the fair is still going strong here in Wisconsin, but did fairs play an even bigger role in Wisconsin earlier on when the state was more uniformly agricultural?
Yeah, definitely. And it also was valuable because folks were just a little bit more isolated back then. So it was a really good way for practices and words of new machinery to get out a little bit faster and kind of get into the actual hands of the people, you know, people farming on the land and doing those things. So I think it definitely helped advance our ability to produce more efficiently and kind of on a larger scale over time.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Amanda with us in Appleton. Amanda, hi.
Hi.
What is your favorite fair memory or favorite fair experience?
Well, actually, right now, me and my siblings, we're getting ready for the Outagamie Fair. We have to drop off our projects on Wednesday, and we're in the last-minute fair rush that happens every year.
And what are your projects? Tell us about them.
I take cake decorating, photography. I'm trying oil painting this year. Child development, things like that.
Wow. And so do you get judged on all of this?
Yeah, we do face-to-face judging, most of us on Wednesday from 10 to 6, but some are the next day, like music.
What do you think your best shot is at a ribbon?
Well, last year, I'm also doing a 4-H promotional video, and last year my video got sent to the state fair.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
Well, cool. Well, Amanda, thank you so much for calling and sharing that, and good luck to you on all your projects that you're dropping off.
Thank you.
That was Amanda there getting ready for the Outagamie County Fair. She's got some projects looking for some wins. And what about that education component, Lee, where you work on different things? She's trying oil painting and cake decorating and photography.
Yeah, definitely. I think the fair gives you a really good venue to kind of expose yourself to some new things. So you can try out new skills and take on new projects. And in fact, I know multiple people that were kind of exposed to the careers they have now through some of those 4-H projects. You know, trying something new and actually finding out that you really like it and then turning that later into an education and ultimately a career. But yeah, that learning process definitely happens many months before the fair even starts.
And let's take another caller now. We've got Greg joining us in Minneapolis. Greg, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, both my daughters were involved with 4-H growing up, and I just think it was just such a good tool for them to just basically learn about the competitiveness of life in general.
Really? So was it pretty high stakes, the 4-H competitions?
Oh yeah, they you know, of course, in at least in Minnesota, a lot of the county fairs are always concluded by the time the state fair arrives, because that's where the all the winners of the various county fairs in various categories and so on go to compete for the state title.
Ah, so they had a shot at going to the state fair too. So Greg, thank you so much for joining us. Greg is looking back fondly on what his daughters learned, and he says it prepared them for the real world. What about that?
Yeah, I think the competition aspect is definitely important. You know, it gives you that drive to really perform well, and also, you know, learning opportunities. So if you don't do so well next year, the judge usually gives you reasons for why that was. And you can, you know, use that and improve next year and hopefully do better. So I think that's, you know, a crucial component of the whole experience.
How big a role do you think does agriculture play today as compared to the past?
Well, certainly, I think, you know, fairs have definitely changed, but I think that competition and that agricultural root of the fair really still is at the heart, and I think that is a big draw for a lot of fairs. It's kind of what sets a fair apart from other carnivals and festivals. You know, they all have music and food, but at the fair you can see exhibits, you know, whether they're agricultural or not. But gives you an opportunity to kind of make that connection with the rural population, make that connection with the people that are actually on the ground farming, and it gives it just another additional educational component for the actual visitors. And I think that's something that's still a real strength of the fairs, and I think that's a draw for many folks.
We're talking with Lee Presley right now from UW Extension about the history of fairs in Wisconsin and also the role that farming and agriculture play And we'd love to hear from you about this, your favorite fair memory. Did you go when you were a kid, maybe with your parents and your brothers and sisters and your friends? Did you enter stuff in the fair? Did you ever take part in livestock exhibitions or maybe some other things, maybe quilting or painting, cake decorating like we were hearing about? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And we'd also love to hear what your favorite fair is these days. And Lee, if you're not so much into the farming and the agriculture, where do you think fairs have diverged since those early kind of agrarian roots? What kind of stuff do you find now that you would never have found back then?
I think that the emphasis on the rides and the fun, I mean, although back then they were still fun because it was a social opportunity, I think, you know, fairs are really trying to do more to draw kind of from a wider population outside of just the rural population. So I think, you know, although that's become an emphasis, there is still, you know, there's a little something for everyone.
And what is your experience growing up with state fairs and county fairs?
Well, I was a proud member of a 4-H club up in Marathon County. I showed a variety of projects, but certainly one of my favorites was showing dairy cows. And my club was very much into priding in ourselves and how well we took care of our animals in our exhibits. So oftentimes we would compete for herdsmanship, which was a club-level competition that awarded you for keeping your animals looking really nice and your exhibit looking really clean and sharp. So we spent a lot of time in the barn, you know, just socializing and cleaning up after our animals, keeping things looking nice, and just trying to be a good ambassador for any visitors that might come through.
This conversation is making me want to go to a fair right now. I know they're spread out over Wisconsin, and it seems like, you know, you hear about the state fair, it gets statewide publicity, but how do you find out about the county fairs, Lee?
Sure. So, yeah, there's a lot of county fairs going on even right now. This week, the Racine County Fair starts, which I will be going to. But there is a list of all of the Wisconsin fairs going on, and that is at www.wifairs.com. And that has all of the fairs, including little county fairs, and then also our state fair, which begins August 3rd.
Do you think the county fairs especially, have their unique personalities? They have things that make them unique?
Yeah, certainly. I've been to a number of them, and my fair growing up was relatively large, but I've gone to a lot of other counties and seen all kinds of scales of fairs, and, you know, the exhibits are always, you always are going to see about the same in terms of what exhibits are offered for the 4-H projects, but definitely the scales and kind of the local flavor is definitely set apart, and the food available. You see some unique items at each different fair.
Yeah, what is one that stuck out to you?
Well, down here at the Racine County Fair, they have, I think they're called pink tacos. So that's something unique that I've never seen. And of course, I have a real fondness for the cheese curds at the Lions booth at the Wisconsin Valley Fair, which think are probably the best cheese curds in the state. I haven't had better.
But wait, what is a pink taco?
I'm not really sure where it gets its name from. I think maybe the logo has, I don't know if it's got a pig in it or something, but they are pretty delicious, and it's kind of, I mean, it seems like it's a more healthy alternative to some of the other fair foods out there.
I just saw, well, not just, but I recently saw the movie, the latest Diary of a Wimpy Kid, and they stop off at a fair and they eat butter on a stick, so it's deep-fried butter on a stick. Is that a real thing?
You know, I don't know if I've ever had it. I think I've had a deep fried Snickers bar, which that was delicious.
I don't know if I need butter on a stick.
I don't think I'd go that far.
We're talking to Lee Presley right now from UW Extension about the history of fairs, what makes them unique, and also about the role of agriculture. And we'd love to hear from you right now at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite part about your local fair? What about the state fair? Do you have a tradition of going? What is your favorite food when you go there? And what do you have to make sure to do each year? And if you're involved in maybe farming or agriculture, do you take part in that aspect of it? Do you enter animals or do other parts of say, the 4-H programs there? And let us know at 800-642-1234. If you participated in these programs, what have you gotten out of them? Have they maybe shaped who you are? Call us at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page, and we'll continue our conversation and get to your calls. calls in just a little bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert, and right now we're picking up our discussion about the role of agriculture and what it plays in state fairs and county fairs. Also hearing about your favorite fair memories and a bit about the history of fairs in Wisconsin. Right now, Lee Presley is with us. She's an agriculture educator with the Racine and Kenosha County UW Extension. And we're hearing from you at 800-642-1234. Have you ever taken part in an agriculture competition at a state or a county fair? What did you learn? And what is your favorite fair memory? Maybe growing up or maybe now. Maybe you're looking forward to one. Why do you go to the state fair or the county fair? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we go to our callers now. We've got Jennifer first in LaCroix. Jennifer, hi.
Hi.
What is your favorite fair experience?
I actually grew up in Iron County in the very north part of Wisconsin, and I was just wanting to share that I really liked having counties up by where I grew up, because having access to a large state fair just wasn't possible. So having those local connections and that fun activity every summer to look forward to is really great.
And did you go just once, or did you hit it more than one day?
I was a member of 4-H, so I would go a couple different times. I wasn't involved with the animals, but I did the crafts and things like that.
And do you have fond memories of that and what you might have learned from it?
Oh, absolutely. I think I learned a lot about time management, just kind of making sure I was prepping for my demonstrations and presentations, and then just a lot of great friendships grew out of that, too.
Ah, fantastic. And Jennifer, before I let you go, do you still go to the fair?
I do. I don't live in Iron County anymore, but I'm fortunate to be by both Pierce and St. Croix County, so we go to those fairs.
Nice. Well, I hope you have a good fair-going season, Jennifer.
Thank you.
And Lee, she grew up going to the fairs up in her part of the neck of the woods there and took part in 4-H as well. Is that a typical experience about what people get from these state fairs and county fairs?
Yeah, I think as a youth exhibitor, what I really valued growing up was the friendships and also getting to know kids that were from across the county. So, you know, I was used to kind of my little pocket, and it kind of gave me some friends in different areas, which I really, really valued, kind of expanded my horizons at the time a little bit. You know, coming from a rural area, a lot of, you know, kids are... Your friends are whoever's in the neighborhood. So, and those were often, you know, for myself growing up, my neighbors were also the kids that I showed with at the fair and exhibited with at the fair. So lifelong friendships came out of that for sure.
Well, thank you so much for that call. We appreciate it. And we're going to go next to Barbara joining us in Waupaca. Barbara, hello.
Hello. I really enjoy the fair here in Waupaca. And my neighbor was with the extension, UW Extension, so she was very involved. And their daughter participated in the horse, you know, riding with the horses and that competition. So I always love to go to that. And it's really fun to see the little kids with their, sometimes they have smaller horses, and they try to make them go through their paces that they're supposed to go through. And then, of course, the older ones are all really pretty good at it. And it just really is fun to watch them go through. And after they've gone through their regular paces and the scheduled competition and the judging, then they would have a costume parade. And they would have costumes for the rider and for the horses. And there was this one little girl, she was maybe 9 years old, and she had her horse dressed up like a bee. She had a miniature pony, I think, type. And she had it dressed up like a bee, and she was a beekeeper. And it was just the funniest thing. But
wow.
They had all kinds of cute things. And then they also have where they are without a saddle, the two of them have to ride around and do these things. Then they have to stop their horse. And the one who is in front has to switch and to be in the back, and the one in the back has to come in the front without getting off the horse. And so these teams have different strategies for how they're going to get the person in the back to the front. And I think the kids really enjoyed it.
Oh, that sounds really fun. Barbara, thank you for sharing that. I've never seen that. I've never seen the horse and rider costume contest or the assembly line thing she was talking about. But I will say, Barbara, I agree with you. The horses are always my favorite part of the animal displays at the fair. Sometimes the bunnies, they're really cute too, but I definitely love the horse stuff. Have you heard of the kinds of fun horse and rider things that Barbara was describing, Lee?
Yeah, there's, I wouldn't consider myself a horse person. I was in the dairy barn a lot, but I did have a lot of friends that exhibited horses, and, you know, there was all sorts of different shows outside of just the individual competitions that were held. And again, I think that kind of helps with some of the bonding that happens when you're competing and doing things kind of across, not only on an individual level, but with others, and kind of helps to add to that camaraderie.
We're talking with Lee Presley right now, an agriculture educator with the Racine and Kenosha County UW Extension, and we're talking about the fair, about county fairs, state fairs, what you like to do there, if you take part in some of the farming stuff or work with animals like we just heard about, some of the horse and rider activities, and what about the food, the favorite state fair food? Do you think that fairs are still thriving today in Wisconsin? How healthy is your local fair? Let us know at 800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. We heard about how fairs are a focal point for a community to come together, especially in rural areas. Do you find that where you live? 800-642-1234. And we go next to Farmer Steve in Blanchardville. Hello there.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
So, I grew up near Campbellsport, Wisconsin, and I used to show calves with the 4-H at the Fond du Lac County Fair for probably 4 or 5 years when I was a kid. And it is the best experience, I think, that you can go through as a kid, whether you're growing up on a farm or not. We would sometimes be able to convince some of our friends who didn't live on farms to come to the farm and actually pick out their own March calf and train it and show a calf at the fair. And you know, I don't know how the regulations are now, but we used to just sleep right in the pens with the animals. They're
wow.
So tame. And I would ride my cow. I would lay on it. Like, you know, they just become like your best friend. And I had the opportunity to show a March calf, and I won first with her. And then the following year, showed her as a heifer, won first with her again, then showed her calf and won first with her calf 2 years in a row. So that was my favorite memory, I guess, of showing calves at the fair.
And Steve, clearly you're a farmer now because you gave the name Farmer Steve. And then did the state fair did the fair have anything to do with that?
I think so. I mean, I was in the military for a while, and when I got out, I just felt like something was missing. I had got an engineering degree, and I was like, I can't live in a cubicle. So I think a lot of that. Not that all engineers live in a cubicle. Let me just say that, but I had a calling, you know, to get back out on the farm after I'd gone through all that. And it's just been very healing for me as a veteran on a lot of levels. And so now I'm just trying to help connect veterans with farms and that kind of thing.
Oh, that's terrific, Steve. Thank you so much for calling up. We appreciate that. And those memories you have about the closeness living with your animal, it's fantastic to hear and to share that story. Lee, any final words of encouragement to get people out to the fair?
Yeah, well, there's so much to do. There's something for everyone. Make sure, though, for sure you check out the exhibits because the kids work hard throughout the year, and it's just a really great venue to see all sorts of neat projects. Would also like to promote UW Extension's presence at the State Fair this year. So there will be a lot of educational displays in the Exploratory Park segment where UW Extension will be August 3rd through 13th.
Terrific. Lee, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That was Lee Presley, agriculture educator with the Racine and Kenosha County UW Extension, talking about fairs in Wisconsin. And you can find a link to the piece she wrote on wiscontext.org.